content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Avra Lewis from NC Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence in Ebony magazine. Our first article today is actually titled Edward Wilkerson. When asked to describe the aesthetics of his East Hampton, New York home, Edward Wilkerson pauses, careful to consider the question. It's an eclectic melange of my world travels. The fashion designer and avid collector says at last, I love Africa, Bali, Asia, Paris. I wanted to be able to walk from one room to another and feel the effect of time travel in my own home. Mission accomplished. One stroll through his two-story modernist digs with a sprawling multi-level wraparound deck and ocean views from every angle, and the cultural references begin to make sense. Each turn is an extension of Wilkerson's favorite places. The art gallery and outdoor space transport you to Bali. His living room's eccentric style is French, African, Asian. And the upstairs study gives off sexy Parisian library vibes, with books overflowing whenever there's space for them to live. I never feel disconnected from the places I've been, he adds. These places inspire me still. Wilkerson has been collecting beautiful things for 3 decades, along with colorful antidotes that add a little something extra to the artifacts, sculptures, paintings, pottery, textiles, and furnishings he's amassed. These days, he prefers his quaint coastal escape to his former residence in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. Being out here is like traveling, he says. We're always doing something cultural and creative. I've met more people in East Hampton than I ever did in the city. His parting affirmation for young black creatives. It's life, he says. It's your movie. Next article is entitled More Than My Status. Jessica Gillespie was just 22 years old in 2009 when she visited the doctor complaining of swollen lymph nodes in her neck. She suspected the swelling might have been caused by a physical altercation with her roommate the night before, but she wanted to be sure. Her physician drew some blood and scheduled an appointment for a biopsy. When the results came back, the doctor delivered harrowing, unexpected news. She had tested positive for HIV. I was thinking about my boyfriend and how devastated he was going to be, she remembers. I was also thinking about my ex-boyfriend, who had been my college sweetheart before I moved to Georgia. I was more concerned about what my diagnosis meant for everybody else. I was not educated on what HIV means, or even was. I thought it meant I had AIDS. It wasn't until 2 years later that Gillespie learned how she had contracted the virus. A former beau had been born with HIV, but had never disclosed his status to her. I found out through a close family member of his, she says. He had me believe that I gave him the virus, and not the other way around. How does someone do that and sleep at night? In 2011, Gillespie moved back to her home state of Illinois to change her life and adjust to her new normal. She went back to school, had 2 children, both whom are HIV negative, and started using her voice as an AIDS/HIV advocate. Then, in 2016, she received a Facebook message from an old crush named Jordan. He said he was okay with the status and even moved to Illinois to be with her. They got married in August 2017 and had a child together who, like Gillespie's older children, was born HIV negative. She was finally living a dream she had never thought possible, with a family to call her own. But the magic didn't last. Gillespie's marriage was tested when she thought her HIV status was being used as an emotional weapon. The problems in their marriage seemed insurmountable. One of the challenges when you're dealing with any chronic illness, specifically HIV, is your mental health, Gillespie explained. I felt like I couldn't tell my story and preach the importance of self-care when I wasn't living that. She eventually had to come to Jesus moment, after which she left her husband and relocated to Texas with her three children. The fresh start wasn't easy, but turned out to be her best decision yet. Today, Gillespie is able to manage her virus and with one pill a day. As a busy mother pursuing her MBA, she now makes it a point to safeguard her mental health through therapy, while also working on her memoir, which she hopes to publish in 2020, she feels affirmed in her purposes as she helps other women with HIV find light in the dark. I want women living with this virus to know they don't have to settle for less, she says. Don't beat yourself up for the decisions that got you there. Take them as lessons learned. It gets better. Next article is from a section called Black Girl Approved. The title of the article is Stick and Move. In today's fast-growing fitness industry, it's easy to get caught up in the latest craze. For many of us, however, the goals are pretty simple. Feel good, look great, and build strength. Boxing checks all the boxes. Indeed, toned arms and enviable washboard abs are the hallmarks of most diehards in the glove game. Aside from the physical conditioning you'll get, hitting the bag is an excellent stress reliever, making it a terrific outlet for Black women. I paired up with Essence Relationships and Wellness Director Charlie Penn for a session with Reese Scott, founder of Women's World of Boxing, WWB. This all-female boxing gym in New York City is owned and operated by a Black woman. I should confess that I'm notoriously undisciplined when it comes to exercising. So to say that I entered the building feeling a little anxious would be a major understatement. But thanks to WWB's no-frills regimen and choreographed combos and bag work, you don't need props to get a killer workout. We warmed up with 2 3-minute rounds of jumping rope. Then our hands were taped and slipped into boxing gloves, and it was off to the ring. First, we covered some fundamentals, the classic boxing stance, how to step into and throw a jab properly, and cross punching. Then we moved on to sidestepping punches, pivoting, and counter punching. Once we mastered the basics, we took turns going head to head with Scott, jabbing and cross fists in a series of combos. Finally, it was time to apply what we had learned to the heavy bags. We completed 4 3-minute rounds before wrapping with 2 rounds on the speed bag. It felt exhilarating to punch the heavy bag, and Scott says, "I'm a natural." The 2-hour session worked every inch of our bodies, yet we left with more energy than we'd had when we started. Best of all, I completely tuned out random thoughts during my workout. That almost never happens when I hit the gym. I think I finally found my fitness happy place. Throwing some blows to beat the stress and get in shape is definitely Black Girl Approved. Next is What Would Whitney Want? This is the section called The Breakthrough. When I first met Whitney, it wasn't like our friendship was a sexual or physical thing, Crawford says, of the time their paths crossed in 1980, when the two were teen summer camp counselors in East Orange, New Jersey, but there was a depth and a connection that we had, and it was beautiful. Their relationship quickly blossomed into a friendship so precious to Crawford that she is only now ready to set the record straight on exactly what she and Houston meant to each other. Ours was a bond that deepened over time, and the friendship never stopped growing, she says. Since Houston's passing, many have tried to tell her story. Documentaries and television interviews attempted to piece together the untold mysteries surrounding the legendary entertainer's eventful life and tragic death, from an accidental drowning, with drugs and heart disease being factors. The world heard from her ex-husband, singer Bobby Brown, family members, friends, and acquaintances, but Crawford's voice was noticeably missing from the conversation. She has refused to comment publicly on the singer's life and on their close personal friendship until now. But why now? Because Crawford wants Houston's fans to know and love the Whitney she remembers best. I never had a vision of speaking publicly about my life with Whitney, she explains. I had to move forward, but in the years after her death, everything I heard and read about her was concerning, troubling, and I just felt, why is it all so negative? That was the tone. Here was this woman with this extraordinary legacy, this amazing talent, and anyone and all anyone can talk about is this negative. Houston's death shattered Crawford. Then fresh tragedy struck when the singer's daughter, Bobby Christina, passed away at 22 in July 2015. With so much pain surrounding Houston's legacy, Crawford felt she owed it to her friend to clear up the public misconceptions about their personal lives and to tell Houston's truth as only she could. That's when she began putting their story on paper, starting from the beginning. Crawford remembers the moment in 1980 when she first laid eyes on the vibrant 16-year-old Houston, whose peachy brown skin was so radiant that it stopped her in their tracks. They instantly bonded and started hanging out together after their counseling jobs were done each day. For the next 22 years, they were inseparable friends and sometimes roommates who shared the fast life of fame and together made once-in-a-lifetime memories across the globe. So deep was Houston's regard for Crawford that their personal and professional lives soon became one. Crawford, who began as Houston's assistant and later co-managed the singer's company, Nippy Inc., was instrumental in guiding her career from its early stages up to her megastardom days. In her account, Crawford reveals that Houston, who was far more private than many might suspect, had asked her to help manage her affairs because Crawford was the person whose love for her she trusted the most. Crawford says she no longer feels bound by the constraints of the past. This is evident in the book when she discloses that their ever-changing relationship was, at times, romantic. She vividly describes the intimacy of their first kiss and sexual encounters they shared. Our friendship was deep because we were open, she says. We were bare. We were naked with our feelings. We didn't think about what we were saying. We just said it. But nothing lasts forever. In 2000, Crawford grew concerned about how things were unfolding in Houston's life, and she began to feel that she could no longer support her in the way she had before. Crawford also desperately wanted to prove that she could swim on her own. So she resigned from the singer's management team and moved forward with her life, determined to establish an independent career. Afterward, she reconnected with a former love, Lisa, whom she had met while working with Houston on The Bodyguard. The two later married and became the parents of twins. But despite Crawford's exit from Houston's inner circle, she never let go of her memories and the special relationship she shared with the singer. Although there was more distance between her and Houston after she left Nippy Inc. and moved out of the state, the two still talked and never stopped being friends, despite what was reported in the press. And that supposedly beef between her and Houston's ex, Bobby Brown, it didn't exist. When Whitney chose to partner with someone, I was honored to be the maid of honor at her wedding, says Crawford. I didn't know Bobby before the wedding. We never really got a chance to know one another, but what I will say is that she told me she loved him. Even after Houston was married, their close friendship continued. Crawford insists. For the record, she adds, Bobby and I were not squaring off in everlast shots in boxing gloves. That never happened. I was still in the same spot where Whitney always wanted me to be. Bobby never approached me personally or said anything to me about the rumors of our relationship, not once. But I watched him make a mess of her trail. I wasn't competing with him for anything. I was her friend, and he could have been a better friend, too. One of the most moving passages in the memoir comes when Crawford admits she always believed that she and Houston would have more time together on this earth. I thought we would team up again, she says. I was always there for her. She knew that. There is no doubt in my mind that she knew how much I loved and cared for her and would do anything for her. Even now, Crawford still feels Houston's spirit with her, and perhaps this is her final gift to her friend, an open window into the best parts of their relationship and Houston's undying passion for her music, says Crawford of her long-awaited memoir. I hope that I have set us both free. The next article is from Ebony Magazine, titled, 94-year-old Cicely Tyson says she won't retire. Cicely Tyson is the cover star for Time's second annual Optimist issue, which is the guest edited by prolific filmmaker Ava DuVernay. During her interview, the veteran actress revealed she has no plans to leave Hollywood. When asked about retirement, Tyson replied, "And do what? The reason why I have been in this universe as long as I have been is because he's not ready for me." The actress turned 94 this month. "When I've completed my job, he'll take me away. I know several people who have retired and then 6 months later, they're gone," she added. The honorary Oscar recipient told the publication, "Your daily work routine is a form of exercise that keeps you alive. My rationale says to me, for years, you got up in the morning, you did whatever was required of you to get ready to leave. You ate breakfast, you got in your car or on your train or the bus, and you went to work. You worked all day. Then you went home, you had your dinner. This exercise that you have done for years, what is it that makes you think you can suddenly stop doing that and sit down all day and watch television?" Tyson said she is honored to continue to share her gifts because it's what keeps her going. "You can't just stop because that will be the end of you," she said in conclusion. The next article, titled, "American Black Film Festival Honors 2020 Movie of the Year Award Nominees Announced." The American Black Film Festival, ABFF, honors the preeminent awards event celebrating Black culture and artists who have made distinguished contributions to the entertainment industry, either through their work as champions of diversity and inclusion in Hollywood. Today announced the nominees for its Movie of the Year Award. The ABFF Honors Movie of the Year Award is a competitive award presented to the best feature-length film of the year, directed and or starring a lead actor or actress of African descent. This year's nominees are Black and Blue, directed by Deion Taylor, starring Academy Award nominee Naomi Harris and Tyrese Gibson. Dolomite Is My Name, directed by Craig Brewer, starring Academy Award nominated Eddie Murphy, Keegan-Michael Key, Mike Epps, Craig Robinson, Titus Burgess, and Wesley Snipes. Harriet, directed by Casey Lemons, and starring Golden Globe and SAG Award nominee Cynthia Erivo, who, as previously announced, is set to receive the 2020 ABFF Honors Rising Star Award, which has previously been presenting to Tiffany Haddish. And Ryan Coogler, Just Mercy, directed by Destin Daniel Cretton, starring Michael B. Jordan and Academy Award winner Jamie Foxx, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, directed by Joe Talbot, written and starring Jimmy Fails, Queen and Slim, directed by two-time Grammy Award winner Melina Matsoukas, starring Daniel Kaluuya and Jodie Turner-Smith, and Us, written and directed by Jordan Peele, starring Academy Award winner Lupita Nyong'o. These films collectively represent the diversity and complexity of African American experience in America, said ABFF Ventures CEO Jeff Friday. This has been a phenomenal year for Black content, and we are excited to celebrate its universal appeal and the community of creators behind it. Black and Blue, an action thriller about a rookie cop who inadvertently captures the murder of a young drug dealer on her body cam. After realizing that the murder was committed by corrupt cops, she teams up with the one person from her community who is willing to help her as she tries to escape both the criminals out for revenge and the police who are desperate to destroy the incriminating footage. Dolomite Is My Name. Eddie Murphy portrays real-life legend Rudy Ray Moore, a comedy and rap pioneer who proved naysayers wrong with his hilarious, obscene kung fu fighting alter ego. Dolomite became a 1970s blaxploitation phenomenon. Harriet. Based on the thrilling and inspirational life of an iconic American freedom fighter, Harriet tells the extraordinary tale of Harriet Tubman, escape from slavery and transformation into one of America's greatest heroes. Her courage, ingenuity, and tenacity freed hundreds of slaves and changed the course of history. Just Mercy. After graduating from Harvard, Brian might have had his pick of lucrative jobs. Instead, he heads to Alabama to defend those wrongly condemned with the support of local advocate Eva Ansley. One of his first and most incendiary cases is that of Walter McMillan, who in 1987 was sentenced to die for the notorious murder of an 18-year-old girl. Despite a preponderance of evidence proving his innocence, and the fact that the only testimony against him came from a criminal with a motive to lie. In the years that follow, Brian becomes embroiled in a labyrinth of legal and political maneuverings and overt, unabashed racism as he fights for Walter and others like him, with the odds and the system stacked against him. The Last Man in San Francisco. A young man searches for home in the changing city that seems to have left him behind. Queen and Slim. Slim and Queen's first date takes an unexpected turn when a policeman pulls them over for a minor traffic violation. When the situation escalates, Slim takes the officer's gun and shoots him in self-defense. Now labeled cop killers in the media, Slim and Queen feel that they have no choice but to go on the run and evade the law. When a video of the incident goes viral, the unwitting outlaws soon become a symbol of trauma, terror, grief, and pain for people all across the country. Us, in order to get away from their busy lives, the Wilson family takes a vacation to Santa Cruz, California, with the plan of spending time with their friends, the Tyler family, during a day at the beach. Their young son, Jason, also almost wanders off, causing his mother, Adelaide, to become protective of her family. That night, four mysterious people break into Adelaide's childhood home where they're staying. The family is shocked to find out that the intruders look like them, only with grotesque appearances. Each year, the nominees are determined by a jury from the ABFF's Entertainment Journalist Committee, EJC, who then vote in conjunction with national consumers to determine the winner. Voting for the general public is available via online ballot at www.abffhonors.com/vote. Voting begins on December 28, 2019 and runs through January 15, 2020. For the second year, American Airlines will sponsor ABFF Honors VIP Fan Experience, which is an opportunity for one consumer to attend this exclusive event and celebrate Black excellence among the most influential artists, executives, and stakeholders in the entertainment industry. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Ebony. We hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the NC Reading Service. The content of this program is readily available as a podcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Have a great day.